Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton. With me today is Duncan.
Hello.
And Jeff.
Yellow.
A rare role for our gotcha of hosts this season. We're a bit late, but we are covering the winter 2026. Fuck, it's 2026.
Oh, I know, right?
And February is almost over. I mean, by the time you're listening to it, it will be objectively over. But we have opinions about the anime season now about halfway through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of good stuff. A lot of mid stuff, too. But to focus on the good, let's go ahead and start out with Ikoku Nikki, or Journal with Witch, or as I prefer to call it, Chronicle of a Strange Land.
Which is like objectively the better localization, yeah. But they disagree.
It's okay. Bad title translation is part and parcel with anime, and we just can't think about it too much. So,
if the author herself picks that English title and has it on the original work, what then?
Look, like, this is just like the tearful Wesley Snipes meme where he is like, but it's like death of the author in that case.
Sometimes authors are wrong, but there's not a lot wrong with this show, I have to say.
Yeah.
We touched on this a little bit. Andy was so impressed with it that he hallucinated that he was the only one watching it. But Duncan was watching it. I binged it on a Sunday night. And then had like the saddest day after having watched it, because it is a beautiful story of grief, loneliness, intimacy, and the profound pain and unavoidable pleasure of living with other people. A young girl who loses her parents, moving in with her estranged, eccentric author aunt, and them just kind of finding out how to live. And yeah, I it's going to be hard for me to talk about this because I do think it is so subtle and so smart in almost everything it does. And I will try my best not to spoil the latest episode for you, Jeff. I don't know.
So I think you may be fed up with me talking about Journal of Witch in terms of superlatives, because I did that like a fair amount last cast. And one of my shows of the year last year was Shoshimin, and like I spoke about like seeing a character who has the same struggles with like having great sympathy for people but distinct problems with empathy with people as me. I felt very seen in while watching Shoshimin. I definitely get some of the same stuff with Makio, because she's certainly sympathetic towards Asa, but she really does not have empathy with what she's going through.
Yeah, she's so extraordinarily self-sufficient that she struggles to give this girl like the comforting lies of childhood that she still needs, especially in these past couple episodes we've seen. She begs Makio to like tell her the easy pat answer, and Makio's like, I can tell you what my own conjectures are, but they are not accurate, and you should not listen to them as your sole source of authority. And that's hard for Asa, who has had a mother who, like, every single person describing her is like really put together, like really, really organized, is like what everyone says about, which chisel that on my gravestone. it's hard to like, because like when you're someone who controls the narrative as much as Makio's sister, Asa's mother, clearly did, and you're dead, and suddenly the fact that it's all been revealed as just stage managing a life, which was actually incredibly messy. Yeah, the burden of other people, but at the same time, the loneliness of not being unburdened, and how Makio has built her life to not care either way. It's a magnificent character study, and so subtly presented.
Yeah, like I was gonna say, like it's not so much that Makio is self-sufficient as much as she has just narrowed the aperture of her life to such a degree that she is thriving in the very limited space that she has left for herself. And now that she has to share that with another person, she's realizing that she has these own gaps in her life, and that carrying over her trying to tell her friend's mom, I'm not her parent. Like, I can't be her parent, obviously. In her mind, she has narrowed herself to, I'm not Asa's mom. I can't be, obviously. I'm going to be her cool roommate who takes care of her. and hopefully does the paperwork correctly that the state doesn't take her away. And then she realizes that, like, oh,
hot lawyer to handle.
Yeah. And then she realizes, you know, she's starting to realize, like, oh, that's not good enough, and also maybe that's not good enough for myself. And her, like, her own life growing to accommodate Asa and reaching out to, like, Kasamichi and her other friends, and, like, who will all freely say, like, we really wish Makio would, like, realize that she is living in this tiny little box and we love her, but, like, we would really like her to, like, stretch her wings a little bit. And
yeah, especially her ex-boyfriend agent is just like, yeah, how about you have a fuller life? And she's like, nah.
Nah, I'm good. And, like, yeah, and, like, that especially feels very relatable, because, like, I've been saying in the chat that, like, oh, Makio, literally me, for real, for real. And, like, and, you know, having that, like, sort of, like, that experience of, in the heat of the moment, putting yourself out there in a way that you only realize after the fact that you are not really built for, and being forced to deal with that because you can't really just run away from that. Those are growth moments that only other people can really give you. If you're just, mm-hmm, if you're satisfied being by yourself, you're never going to be put in those situations, but maybe that is what life is being put in those situations.
The beauty and profundity and inconvenience of other people is a wonderful thing that this story has set us up to appreciate. And especially in the latest episode, where we really get a peek into how, like, Makio has built this fictional universe of her writing is an apparatus for her to process her emotions. And so when she's talking to Asa over the dinner table and just, this is what I think, I didn't grieve my father, I do not grieve my sister, I have experienced great sadness, but I will never share it with anybody. And then she turns around and reads these books and is like, oh, it's all in here. And the idea that, like, the dream that you can be without this sadness, without this isolation, that you can build yourself a citadel of emotion that never needs outside supply is presented and then undermined repeatedly, and especially in that final scene of the most recent episode, the seventh episode.
I personally think it's actually most perfectly undermined in the second half of episode five, but just because there's nothing which sort of undermines a sort of dispassionate attitude where you think you're living your life right and you're doing the right thing by just getting horny and basically decide you've got a crush on your ex, and it would 100% the worst thing you could possibly do is act on that, but you really want to act on that.
It's and he's I don't know, that handhold in the car, and then they just hold on her, like, undetailed face, just like dots and lines, because she's just like, he's holding my hand while I'm worried about my adoptive daughter having run away. It's just, it's great. Great stuff. I'm floored with every episode.
It came out of nowhere. It might have been you guys who told me that this is not like an actual fantasy show, because I'd seen like a couple shots, because a lot of the key visuals before it came out were in the, like, the speculative world, because the way the show portrays interiority is dropping people into either like an affective landscape or into a memory, and they're sort of in person watching it. And mm-hmm. So, you know, if out of context, it becomes a fantasy show. And that was what kind of like originally sort of warded me off of it. It was like, I'm not really interested in another thing like this. I thought it was like, you know, another, like, you know, villainess is reincarnated into an isekai.
This
show.
Is why I don't like the title translation. Is yeah. That like Journal with Witch does not dispel the confusion. Like, it's a foreign land. It's an unfamiliar country.
An isekai title as well. It's not necessarily helping. Yeah. I do think like it is one of these adaptations where there is definitely signs of its heritage as a work from the page. That episode five ends with them just about to kiss, or at least mm-hmm. Well, like the fundamental ideas of comics and manga storytelling is what happens between the panels. You show one image and then there's a gap between the next image, and the audience has to fill that in however they choose to.
McLeod.
And in this case, it very much just leaves the audience hanging and 100% hands responsibility over to them for what happens next. next. That's kind of a pleasing thing to have for a show, not to feel like it has to hold our hand, that it can imply stuff rather than just absolutely define it. And I also enjoy the sort of dual protagonists, like that it isn't just about Makio and it isn't just about Asa. It's about seeing that relationship from both sides, because a lot of the stories you will get about less, let's call it, say, socially competent people, we will tend to get one side of that. We don't get much of Gendo's side of the relationship in Evangelion, for instance. We only get Shinji's.
Not until Bye Bye All Indeed. Of Evangelion, where...
Were you going with a Diary of a Strange Land? Because I've seen multiple different ones. Which was the one you'd pick?
As an artist, as a thinker, as someone with multiple degrees, I prefer Chronicle. But I do think Nikki is just so much associated with diaries. Like we think of like Future Diary. Mm. We think of There's like it is an elliptical title. And those are always murder to translate, where it has a lot of implication of fantasy. It has a lot of implication of travel and foreignness, but is not specifically saying anything other. Like the literal translation is Diary of a Strange Place. And like that's many like Marco Polo-esque travel diaries in Japanese culture have that as their effective title. And so there's just a literary corpus that we can't tap into because we are foreigners. We are the foreign land that so many of the diaries were written about. And I don't envy it, but I do think Journal with Witch, every time I've had to explain it to someone, I've had to be like, there actually are no witches, unfortunately. Sorry. But you're in for a treat.
This is just like me building supposition without any evidence, but part of to explain something. But part of me goes, well, I can imagine Journal with Witch is the sort of title Asa would come up with, whereas Chronicle of a Strange Land feels like a Makio title. There's like that straightforwardness in that which feels Asa, and these carefully selected words fits Makio. And so whether or not there's any truth to that, the show's done such a good job of giving me a sense of their characters, I can find the possibility of that expression elsewhere, even if that is just me seeing shapes and clouds.
I mean, it's a subtle, like that's the advantage of subtlety and ambiguity, and it's reflected in the text where, again, like these people are appealing to each other for answers, and the danger, the intimate emotional danger that comes with telling someone how it is regularly rejected, and it makes for a very interesting emotional landscape. Speaking of...
I'll talk about a different show, which is Shibuyugi. There's a lot which makes Shibuyugi different from most shows this season, but it's probably best for me to start talking about what makes it different from its peers, because its full title is Shibuyugi Playing Death Games to Put Food on the Table. And that makes me go yuck. And that's because the most obvious thing you can take away from that title is it's part of that genre. It's part of the whole slate of descendants of the wider sort of battle royal genre. That whole little subgenre sort of like poked its head up in like early noughties, and with things like Saw in like Western culture, and in Japan you have things like Gan. Like its main sort of difference from like the wider battle royal stuff is it's more greater emphasis on the cerebral, on sort of logic and puzzles and trap, but it's also heavily associated with shock and gore, especially with the Western versions. But that certainly goes true from Gan's as well. But the second thing you might get from that title is the number of words in it indicates that it's clearly a light novel title. And the thing is, the constraints of that media and how a director has to adapt them is what I would argue makes this worth people's time. But the written words is, as we're saying with Journal with Rich, is a wonderful thing, but it's notable that when we want to describe a particularly shocking instance of violence, one of the words we'll reach for is graphic, And that's kind of an admission of defeat, mm-hmm. because graphic is visual. This is a sort of an admission that a visual representative of violence incites sort of an instinctual reaction in us that words struggle to. Instead, words have to sort of deal with what they're good at, which is things like interiority and implication. Two things which I think you highlighted with, again, you highlighted with Journal of Witch. Mm-hmm. In Shibuyugi, there's no blood. There's no visceral red splash to tell us something horrible has happened. Instead, it does its work by very claustrophobic framing and sort of a visual style that almost wanders into sort of like dreamy abstraction until it decides to come back into focus. And like, I tried to push both you and Jeff hard to watch this, and I'm glad that Jeff actually has in the end.
But no, Jeff's a hero. I was busy watching Trigun Stargaze. Yeah.
Well,
we all punished ourselves in our own ways.
Yeah. it would be interesting to see what Jeff thinks, because this does feel like, to me, a work that is very difficult to judge until you see it in motion. You can see it in screenshots or GIFs, and I don't think it really does justice to what its cumulative effect. It has this sort of compelling, tense atmosphere to it, and I think it builds that over time, and I don't think you can get that from just one clever shot or one striking composition. For me, I feel it's like a very powerful testimony to like what restraint can do in animation, what purposefulness can do in direction. I don't know if it's good. I really don't know if it's good or not, but it is just an interesting piece of work within the greater body of work that exists, and doing things, as I say, with constraints that others wouldn't choose.
So I'm going to preface this by saying I have only seen the first double-length episode. I found it somewhat frustrating in the way that it was composed. Like you were saying, the director executes some really excellent compositions. The show looks interesting. My only beef with it, like you were saying, like rather than concentrating on the gore, like there are these weird subversions where one thing I find really frustrating is that there seems to be rules happening, like metagame rules that Yuki, the protagonist, is aware of that isn't explained. And you know, I'll get into like over explaining like anime rules on a later show that we're going to talk about.
Same.
But and I get the impression that the episode order is not necessarily the chronological order that the story is going to be told in, because we are told that this is her 28th death game. The second episode is going to be her 10th death game.
The obvious thing we have to bring in then is Yuki hasn't necessarily always told the truth. So who knows which of those statements is correct, if either.
But with death games, like Squid Game is the, you know, the obvious touchstone for these. And what makes them interesting is you have to have a really firm understanding of what the stakes and the, like, what the environment is, what everybody in the game is dealing with, so that you can sort of project yourself into it. And then either, you know, you have it subverted in some clever way that is satisfying, or it like rubs your face in the horrible consequences of the death game going wrong. And this show, there seems to be something going on where injuries are not permanent. If you survive the death game, you are returned to your like normal physical body, but presumably dying is permanent. Yeah. Again, this is not something that is made clear. So
there is a deliberate ambiguity about the amount of damage someone can take.
Yeah.
And they have a contrivance where they say people are given a drug which basically changes their physical properties so that essentially that you can't bleed out. You have almost stuffing almost. You've almost become like a doll. You don't have innards. You just have this like white stuffing instead of blood or whatever. So often in a show which wants to sort of shock, it's the classic bloody splash across the camera. Like that's just not possible here because they've surgically removed that from the equation. And so instead, all the violence is cut to the implement of violence, cut to the reaction of someone. It's always focused on the reaction to the possibility of violence, that fear of it. It lets you imagine it, like I was saying with Journal of Witch, it wants you to imagine what's happening. It wants you to bring that trap and spring it shut on a person for you to fill it that in rather than for it to do it. It's clearly very self-aware because it even makes a comment about if people were seeing the blood, it would spoil the enjoyment of the game caring for them, and it does have this sense, like, as you say, like, all we know about Yuki is she said, my aim is to survive 99 of these. We don't know why she wants to. We don't know what purpose that would serve. All of these things are the grander game. It's saying, here are the... I'm not sure if you'd call her an author insert, but or an audience insert, but there's definitely some of that. She definitely, having this character who is aware of the rules, in the same way that an isekai protagonist is thrown in with that awareness of what's going on, definitely does give her an advantage with others, which the audience can sympathise with. It's like, oh, yes, of course, her decision is right, because we as the audience would make that same decision knowing about the genre and what to expect, not like these silly mooks who are running around into traps, etc. I don't know.
Yeah, like in the first episode, I'm getting the impression that Yuki sort of becomes the connective tissue throughout. I'm gonna guess that each death game has her and then a different cast of characters. Maybe some will repeat, maybe some won't. But each story is actually about one of the other competitors, because, like, in the first episode, Kinko is actually, like, the main character who... She comes in, you know, she has a debt to pay off, and then she has, like, immediate regret because she survives one of the death games, you know, at the expense of somebody else, and then she sort of, like, learns to hope and love again, and then, spoiler warning for the first episode, is unceremoniously killed off by Yuki so that Yuki can win the death game. And the fact that the way the games are played out, it's not always clear what the stakes are or what the mechanisms are, and if the perspective character is supposed to be Kinko, who is, like, so wrapped up in her own fragile emotional state, that makes sense. But as a viewer of the death game genre TV show, I find it frustrating, and it feels like it needs another go-around with an editor. The first section of the death game, they explore this whole floor of a mansion. It's not clear how many rooms they go through. It's not clear how long they're doing that. It's not clear what they're looking for. And then everything happens in the first room that they were in. And if they had spent more time just being in that one location, foreshadowing the dangers, foreshadowing the traps, so that you could more easily put together what happened when, you know, the thing that goes wrong, I would have found that a lot more satisfying. Or in the second game, where they're in the tall room and it's implied that water is going to be filling up the room, but then giant buzzsaws come down from the ceiling and the water is, it doesn't make any sense. Like, it almost feels like somebody, like a DM winging it, like entering a room with one idea and then just kind of going with it throughout. And I don't know if that is going to improve as the series goes. I'm going to watch another couple episodes because it's intrigued me enough so that these kinds of nitpicky things are the things that are bothering me, and not just like, I am put off by maids doing death games, I'm out. It's captured me just enough for me to be annoyed by the details, you know what I mean?
To me, I feel you need a certain arbitrariness to the rules, because it shouldn't be a fair game. No one should ever be playing the fair game, because if you want to say anything about this sort of thing, which this clearly does to an extent, is that we should always know that this game is unfair, this because someone wants to see people have to make horrible decisions. And to the interesting thing is, like, to see Yuki and to get the sense that, why would you be prepared to do that? Why would you be prepared to become that person, to make that decision? What motivation could possibly drive you on? Like, because we're seeing everyone else's, we're seeing why they would go to this lens, but we don't see hers. And we're sort of having to imply it bit by bit, as, like, she's the mystery rather than the games, if that makes sense. Obviously, that sounds incredibly pretentious, and it probably is, but...
My complaints is less I don't understand the motivations of the characters, is that I don't physically... Like, I don't understand what's physically happening in the scene, and I'm trying to sort of reconstruct in my mind what happened while they're explaining what's happened.
Okay.
Like, that is the frustration that I have. Like, when the first character is killed, you know, she picks up the plate of macarons and finds the keys, and then Yuki says, hey, wait, there's probably a trap, because that's an important thing. And then there's a sound and a long shot, and then somebody falls over, and then there's a shot of a spike in the wall with no blood on it, and then everybody is screaming, and it's like, did the spike shoot out of the wall? Where did it come from? Did it hit her? Is she dead? Like, none of these things are just made immediately clear. Like, I've seen like clips of the director's other shows where he does those like kind of like interesting long shot, almost impressionistic things, but in a more grounded situation where like you don't have to account for like, you know, where did this spike shoot from? Like what actually happened here? Like with Saw, they go great lengths to tell you exactly, you know, you have this chain on your leg, you have to cut your leg off with this saw, you know, hence the title of the movie.
Yeah.
And then you're left stewing in everybody's, you know, psychological issues and histories and the emotions and the gore and everything else, but you have a firm understanding of they're in this bathroom, they have these tools, they have these limitations, and now, you know, you can project yourself into that. Whereas in this, the world itself is as dreamy and confusing as the people in it.
Yeah, yeah. Predating Saw, there was I think the first thing I ever saw of this kind of thing was a science fiction film called Cube. I don't know if you've
Used... Yeah. Canadian classic.
Yeah. That tried to blend sort of, not quite cosmic horror, but sort of unknowable motivations behind whoever was creating these rooms. You were not supposed to have a clear understanding of why these traps existed and what they were supposed to. And I think...
But when they happened, like, that movie's entire point was to show you disgusting ways of people getting, you know,
sliced up and etc.
Sliced up and burned with acid and everything else like that. You know, you got the gore front and center. Like there wasn't any kind of like impressionistic. I'm not going to say pretentious because I feel like, I don't know, maybe I do mean pretentious. Maybe this is like an actual good use of the word, but like.
There's a great article on Anime News Networks this week in anime column by Christopher Farris and Sylvia Jones on Shibuyugi on the idea of its pretentiousness or not pretentiousness, etc. One thing they touch upon, and which is true here, is like pretentiousness is an affectation, and I don't think what it chooses to are affectations. They are choices. They are deliberate things it commits to, and so I don't feel like it is pretentiousness. I think things are done with a reason, and I can see why, where there are moments where it is doing something without a reason, then it starts to feel pretentious and you're like, did you trick me? That specific scene you mentioned, I kind of actually like it because I felt like it was supposed to be messy and confusing because they are all confused. Everyone's like, oh God, what's happening? And so I think we're supposed to feel like they are. We're supposed to be like, oh God, what's happening? But as they start to understand things more, it starts to become clearer to us as well. Like, but yeah, it is definitely an imperfect work, but I do think it is at least trying things which not many other things do in terms of its direction. And I don't generally find many shows make me tense, and this doesn't really have jump scares, and yet I've gone on and watched a couple more episodes so I could talk about it. I was genuinely feeling quite tense about it, on edge about what would happen, even though we know what's going to happen. We know because the episode count and because of the scene count. So that's the other thing which is worth mentioning. Just like generally, much beloved Monogatari, it numbers its scenes at the start of Flash Up, 0 of 33 or 29 or whatever, and it'll count down through that. You'll know how close you're getting towards the end of this story. And the interesting thing is, sometimes it skips chapters, sometimes things are omitted. That's a interesting question of what are we seeing and what aren't we seeing.
Yeah, because in that first episode, to my knowledge, I don't think any of the chapters were skipped. Some of them were kind of breezed over, like when they're cleaning up after the... like the water room game. But I was actually wondering if, in, you know, because the games themselves are not in order, if we're going to also be getting chapters that are out of order and if we're going to be expected to keep track of that.
In the most recent episode, Yuki said this is her 10th game, and in the first episode she obviously says it's the 28th, and before the episode we get this big like title jumble of words which has number 28, Ghost House, and assume that's the both the name of the chapter and the number it is in her particular chronology, but I certainly think they're playing with me. It's clearly giving me false clues, just as it gives them false clues. Yeah. I think we've probably talked enough about this.
Yeah, I was actually going to say...
I'm impressed, honestly.
One show that it actually, like, the directorial style reminded me of Garden of Sinners, a UFO table show that every now and then they would just start feeling themselves and start going nuts with it and getting really silly with it, even though, you know, maybe the content of the story did not necessarily match. And you're watching a UFO table right now, show right now, aren't you, Duncan?
We're very much going back to the other show, which I had to talk about because Andy violently stole a journal from Witch from me, Fate Strange Fake, which is a proper unlimited budget works show. we're back to a battle royal, and I think it's a good that we've come to this after Shibayugi, because like the other thing Battle Royale and Death Games are both obsessed with, of course, Jeff, is rules. And over the past couple of decades, the Rules of Fate franchise has certainly amassed into a proper tome of lore. What makes Fate Strange Fake worth watching, as I said before, is it's written with a disregard to those rules. And to be a bit more specific, it's very much about the spirit of the law rather than the letter. Like it's it's about going and thinking about what was the core that made the original stories interesting, what drew people in, and how can the show reconnect. It has always been like the legends facing off against other legends, and but what makes that interesting, like because a legend itself is not a thing set in concrete. It's very much a lie built upon the bones of a truth. How that legend takes form is very much a context of where it is and when it is told. Fate has ultimately been about how different individuals react with these stories, like how it just pushes those legends together and it sees how they break. Having this massive set of assumptions of how those legends will work in the Ufa table type moon canon means that every time it decides I'm not going to do it that way, that Saber is almost always some version of King Arthur, and here it's Richard the Lionheart, because Richard was obsessed with Arthur. It's the legend of someone who styled himself after a legend. It's a lie built upon a lie.
Interesting.
And it has fun with that, and that's the main important word for me here. It's fun. It is the most fun thing I am watching this season. It is probably the most fun thing I will watch this year. It was probably the most fun thing I watched last year as well.
I was going to try and join you on that, but it's another double length first episode. Maybe I'll go back to it. Also, I think
we talked a couple years ago about how the double length first episode was becoming a thing, but it's really biting us in the ass now. Well, speaking of legends built on legends, there's another season of Trigun. No longer Trigun Stampede, it's Trigun Stargaze. As far as I can tell, it's an attempt to relitigate the first season, which just simply didn't advance far enough into Trigun Maximum canon to be meaningful. I do not want to spend my whole time bitching about this. I will simply say...
And yet.
Yeah, famous last words. I will simply say that... It's a rare entry where the original creator seems to misunderstand their work to this degree. The lack of agency that Vash has, how he is either figuratively paralyzed or literally held in a glass tube with a psychic man making sure he can't move any limb of his body while his genocidal brother does attempt number two to kill all humans. And give his tedious genocidal speeches about how he's going to absorb other plants in order to kill all humans to stop humans from exploiting plants. I don't know.
I mean, you do know, Ben, I think.
I mean, I do. I'm trying to be graceful. It's not my best trait. But yeah, like, when you change the thematic heart of a work from chronicling the incredible burden that pacifism places on an individual, what a conscious, constant, and intense moral choice choosing not to kill is, and instead make it more about, you know, the differential question of exploiting sentient power plants to make the entire world more comfortable for everybody. It's inevitable, but spending a whole season with people trapped on two ships and then wandering around a intentionally depopulated post-apocalyptic desert world and just having a parade of better characters from previous attempts at this show come in to talk about how pain is necessary, but also it's a mistake to choose pain, or talk about how violence is necessary, but also it's a mistake to choose violence. It's vapid. I struggle. There are occasional moments that brighten. I don't hate the news girls. I think it's dumb to change from insurance to news. I think it's silly, especially now that there's been a planet-wide apocalypse and there is no news agency. And they're just, you know, they're still taking pictures and writing stories. They're not letting that stop them. I wish everybody would just watch the original Trek again. I don't have much to say. Let's please move on. I've embarrassed myself.
I'm just going to get a quick kick in while it's down and just say, like, it's making the exact mistakes I am saying that Fate Strange Fake is avoiding. That it cares more about the letter of the law than about its spirit. Like, do we need to know that Vash and Knives' hair is turning black because they're exhausting their powers? No! Like, that's implied. You should, like, everything we've been told about plans.
They had a whole shot that showed his black hair. He's like, uh-oh. And we don't need someone to be like, okay, I'm a scientist and here's what's going on. His hair is turning black because he's running out of power. It's so it assumes the audience is morons. And I am not that bright, but the way that they are doing it, just it's exhausting. Like, there's no room for subtlety or ambiguity. It's all just like people going from room to room talking about each other. You know what it reminds me of? And this is really mean because J.K. Rowling is an evil person, but it reminds me of the Fantastic Beasts franchise after Harry Potter is what it reminds me of, because there is so much putting a bunch of important people in a room and they all talk about what the plot is, and then we cut to another room full of other important people and they repeat what the plot is, and it's just
I think most of us are still pretty favorable to the original Ghost in the Shell. But I think at times that could also fall into the trap of having two people explaining their philosophies to each other. What makes that work, which makes this fail so badly?
So my thing is, the Ghost in the Shell world, especially the Ghost in the Shell standalone complex world, is big. There are a lot of players. It is not the same 18 people making every single important decision that defines the world. And it reminds me of criticisms of the sequel series of Star Wars, or the revival of Star Trek, where it's just a room of like 20 to 30 people and they're involved in every single important decision that ever happens. There's no town of people doing things right. There's no town of people doing things wrong. There's no great redeemer out there in the desert. It's just Knives and Vash and people who know Knives and Vash, and it's the willingness for Ghost in the Shell to have all these government bodies, to have the civilian government, to have the different branches of the military who are all itching to put their imprint on this new world. It means that there's always an outside pressure. And when you lose these outside pressures, when it's just this guy's ideology versus this guy's ideology, it makes it kind of claustrophobic and suffocating. And that's what I really feel with the Trigun reboot, is there's just not a lot of people there who are important and worth listening to. And I know it's because it wants to put focus on the gung-ho guns that they've rehabilitated, literally rehabilitated in the most recent episode. It wants to put focus on the circle around Knives, the people cohering around Vash. But like, that's not authentic. It does not feel authentic that they're like, maybe this is my paranoia. Maybe this is just me living in 2026, but there's always some fucker you don't know about who's messing things up off camera. And when you don't have the sense of that, it means that their problems feel very small and petty, because this is ultimately a rhetorical disagreement between Vash and Knives. And like the way that they've constructed it, it means that either Knives is going to agree with Vash, Vash is going to die, or Knives is going to die. And that's just it's just a narrow conception of how discourse happens in the real world with real implications. And I find it enormously frustrating that like the number of characters they've introduced, especially in Stargaze, who are just there to be like, Knives is right. Mm-hmm. I agree with Vash. No one's got their own opinion. It's mm-hmm. it's not a foment of energies. It's please
yeah.
take this burden away from me. Someone have a transition.
Well, speaking of shows about people fighting in an artificially depopulated world with too many rules, I've been watching the new season of Jujutsu Kaisen, the Culling Game arc.
Perfect, thank you.
So we pick up right after the Shibuya incident arc, which was almost entirely a series of fights between characters who already had established stakes, and it was just kind of like, you know, letting the conflicts go through and, you know, getting lots of like crazy big fights and having fun that way. But I really get the sense that Akutami Gege, early on in the Shibuya incident, realized, I'm going to be spending the next 2.5 years of my life drawing these people fighting each other and getting sort of like lost in the sauce of planning the next arc, because now in the world of Jujutsu Kaisen, the world knows about curse powers and big monsters, and the bad guys have erected all of these battle arenas and have made contracts with the people in them where, you know, if you want to stay, I'm going to give you superpowers and you're going to have to play in this death game. And if you don't want to stay, then you can all leave, which conveniently creates a whole bunch of urban landscapes that people can like Dragon Ball their way through and create widespread chaos. That is
incredibly convenient, in fact.
Yes. And that you really get the sense that Gege said, these are the things that I'm interested in drawing. This is how I'm going to accomplish it. And by the time he got to it, he had created so many layers of convenience and contrivance that we get subjected to an entire episode, which is effectively a PowerPoint presentation of everybody's motivations being explained, the rules of the Culling Game, of which there are 9, one of the rules being people can use points to add rules to the game. So now you have to like keep track of all of these rules, and which almost entirely exist to create situations where people can fight with their weird powers. Thankfully, like when it's not just like guys punching each other, there are some pretty fun flourishes. Every now and then you're going to get somebody with like, you know, an interesting constraint, and it becomes more like an almost like a JoJo's Bizarre Adventure situation where you have to like figure out what this guy's deal is like in real time. And it does that pretty effectively. And it's MAPPA. They're like making exciting anime by, you know, shoveling people into the golden throne of anime. And so like the spectacle is there. It's one of those like true guilty pleasures, and its highs are pretty high, but man, that one interminable episode of them standing like in a white background with like a flowchart explaining everybody's motivations and what's happening and what the rules are, like it was just horrific. Like, and you can't skip it because you don't know what the hell is going on or why people are talking to the weird little avatar dude or anything like that. So yeah. You know, critical support for this dumb show where when it's just guys fighting, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I watched the first episode and then I realized it'd been a very long time since I've watched any episodes of it. And I was like, I remember none of these people.
Yeah.
And I was immediately like, I'm clearly supposed to be feeling some sort of like pathos as this guy sort of contemplates the horrible things his actions have led to. And yet the one thing I remember about him is everyone was telling him from day one, what you do is going to lead to a horrible outcome. And he's like, well, shucks, what I did led to a horrible outcome. Who could have foresaw this?
And yeah, like JJK for me, it's riding almost entirely on the goodwill that it created by foreshadowing a big tournament arc and then saying, actually, never mind, we're gonna have a baseball episode instead. And I was like, oh man, this guy, I'm ride or die for life for this guy, and he's really testing me on that, because I'm ready for it to get to its like big conclusion. And I'm
ready for it to say something is a classic feeling for this kind of show, I feel like.
Like, yeah, like if at some point they say, you know, if, because like Gojo, the sort of like Super Saiyan Goku stand-in who created the situation in the, you know, earlier in the show where like you couldn't just have like an apocalypse happen because this guy would just step in and solve it, you know, trivially, he gets sort of locked away, and that sort of creates the situation where the whole world starts going to shit. And if he comes back and says, actually, we're going to have another baseball episode, I would be happy. I would probably be disgusted at the same time. But I, being a manga reader, I know that's not going to be the case, unfortunately.
Yeah. This is why I don't read manga, because like I hate it when like I'm watching something, I'm like, this seems like it's got potential, and he's like, no mate, it's going to be shit. And I'm like, why? And he's like, I read the manga, and they're never going to deviate from it. There's never.
Yeah.
I remember 10, 15 years ago, if the manga was shit, they might fix it in the anime, but nope. Not anymore.
Everybody has way too much respect for the source material, and that is one thing you should not have for manga, is respect. Yeah. That is not the purpose of this medium. Love it or hate it, well, that's true.
Speaking of too much respect for the manga, speaking of having a bunch of guys just show up and you're like, wait, I'm supposed to know all these guys. Speaking of wishing someone would show up and fix this, I am watching the final season of Golden Kamuy. I don't dislike it. Let's listen to me, listeners. I don't dislike it, but there are too many guys, and when it's a bunch of soldiers fighting against a bunch of like fifth column revolutionaries and subversives and all that, I expected a bigger body count, and I haven't really gotten it yet. I think three people have died, and one episode ago, the past two episodes were just Asirpa sitting in a room with Lieutenant Tsurumi, the mastermind, who's apparently been orchestrating this since he was a spy in Russia fucking 20 years ago. And they just sit down and they just explain the plot to you, which I resented and appreciated at the same time, the anime experience, because I did not remember all of these characters and I did not remember twists back in seasons 2 and 3. But they all have the gold map now, and they're all rushing to get the gold. And the amount of time that we spend with, like, do you really want gold? Doesn't gold ruin a nation? Like, wouldn't the Ainu be better if they had no gold and they just let Japan conquer them? Which is weird, coming from, you know, Japanese culture, which conquered them. And they're like a dying culture, or like a minority culture.
Especially given the sort of World War One and pre-World War One trappings of Golden Kamuy, and what the Japanese Empire was up to in that time.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's like Hokkaido and Sahalin and the Far East. Like, is it going to be controlled by Russia? Is it going to be controlled by Japan? Is it going to be an independent nation of various allied indigenous peoples? Should that independent nation encompass as much land as possible, or should it like turtle in Hokkaido? And if it does turtle in Hokkaido, do the people who live on reindeer herding or other sort of peripatetic lifestyles, is that betraying them? Like, what does it mean to betray your people? These are interesting topics, but they're kind of caught up in the weird, like, symphony of violent weirdos that Golden Kamuy became many seasons ago and hasn't really paid off. There are great moments. Like, they have a fight in a beer brewery, and there's a guy who seems like he's going to die, and then like the explosion and the falling rubble just like perfectly carries him to like a futon that's been laid out like randomly by the explosion, and then a blanket falls over him, and then a beer bottle like drops right next to his bed, and everyone's like, oh, I guess he's fine. And you know, Shiraishi and Sugimoto driving around in a mascot beer car trying to catch Asirpa as she's being kidnapped by every other character in the show. Like, these important characters just become footballs for different factions to carry over the line. I'm not hating it. I like it more than Trigun Stargaze, but it is definitely like the editor came to the mangaka and was like, you've got to finish this fucking manga. So everyone's just kind of like falling in line, lining up on their sides. Everyone's pushing towards the end. It turns out that the skins they were chasing for, they didn't even need all of them, which is a bizarre choice because the whole show for four seasons was, we need all the skins to solve the riddle. And now we don't.
I mean, frankly, that sounds far more like the mangaka's decided that I want to end this than these editors.
No, it is. Every episode wafts with, I've got to end this fucking show in six episodes. And fair, but also I was hoping for more surprises. It turns out that all the big twists happened in season 3 and 4. And this is mostly just like putting the right people in the right rooms to have the right conversations. Basically the same thing I complained about with Trigun. Endings are hard. Endings are hard. And I will never imply otherwise. But the like hilarious slapstick shonen homoeroticness of Golden Kamuy is gone. And I'm ready to see it ended. So yeah.
Does the Golden Kamuy still at least have a excellent line in Stupid Expressions as they eat good food?
There hasn't been any food. They're not eating. They're all running around a burned down beer brewery for the past six episodes. It's been wild. And flashing back to make sure you really understood that Hasegawa was Tsurumi. Sorry if that's a spoiler for you. They really think it's an impressive twist. I was like, oh yeah, and that's about it. No, there's not enough comedy. There's not enough food. There's not enough man meat.
Speaking of comedy and food, we've got a new series of one of my old favorites. Tis Time for Torture Princess. I'm enjoying myself. I feel like there's been, it's not quite got the budget of the first series, but it's still doing what it needs to do effectively. I enjoy its OP, which is basically the Demon Lord is a big anime nerd, and he's commissioned promotional material to make himself look awesome, and it's all like flashes of lightning as he zooms through the sky, and the princess and her various friends are like, well, no, what if we just did it like a super happy show instead? And he's like, yes.
I'm enjoying this season more just because the further it drifts from the princess pretends she's going to be strong and then falls
that's gone
to like toast with honey on it. Like, my favorite parts, and you're probably going to like gloat, or at least if you had a webcam working, you would be making a gloaty face, are when Torturer, the head torturer, just like has a normal day. Like when she bought like a too expensive sweater.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Or when she's sick and she's trying to decide, like she's hungry and she wants like some delicious food, but she doesn't want to like stress her immune system. That's the stuff that I find the funniest. And the Demon Lord having a completely normal, like extremely mundane middle-class family life is also funny. I'm beginning to wonder if maybe the princess is what doesn't work for me. Because the like the demons just all being completely normal people who just like go to work in modern day Japan effectively, except everyone's got like horns or a tail. Is where the joke lands the best for me. Although when the torture doesn't work and the princess has to like make up the difference and like be encouraging to her torturers to try to get them through, that does work. Although I wish it was more heightened. Her like misreading a price and like paying $300 for like a long sleeve t-shirt and then just like spending the next like 4 minutes trying to like figure out how to rationalize this decision to herself. Extremely funny. That's my kind of comedy.
Yeah.
Relatable.
The whole series being like just, you know, cute girls doing cute things smuggled in on this like very weird premise. It really feels like that mangaka was just like, I gotta get serialized. I gotta find some way of getting somebody to like call me back. So they like came up with this torture gimmick and carried that just long enough to get a commitment. And then it was like, All right, fuckers, now we're going to talk about expensive sweaters. I got you. I got your asses.
And hamster, giant hamsters with cooking YouTube channels.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I also liked that bit too, where it's like, oh, if it's big, it's not actually that cute. And he's like, well, that's okay because I'm also an all-star chef, not professional, but extremely celebrated in my social media. Yeah, no, I like that. It either needs to get like super weird or super mundane. And it's very strange for me that like Torture Princess often occupies a sweet spot where it's not weird or like boring enough to hit my comedy zones. But I'm glad you're liking it. Although, yeah, I do agree that the budget seems to come and go. I don't know.
Mm. Like the first one obviously poured budget into the reaction scenes, like, and there's less of those to go around now because she does just surrender. The joke is now not that she surrenders, it's that each time she surrenders, she's surrendering even quicker than before, and she's surrendering, but she's helping them. They're even forgetting to ask her to surrender. Like,
yeah. That was funny in the latest one. Yeah, they're just like, oh, we forgot. And then we had a whole episode, a whole like sequence about how he had a mouth ulcer, the demon lord, and like got a week off work, which I mostly felt is deep envy for getting a week off work for having a mouth ulcer. I have one right now, actually. So
he is definitely assured that it's like got the best sort of worker benefits for members of the Hell Horde. We know that we live in a capitalist dystopia when literal members of a demonic horde have benefits most people would be envious of.
It feels like everything that's remotely a workplace drama has now like what if a boss was good as like a joke opportunity, so it's kind of hard to deal with. Speaking of what if a no, I can't do that. What if a boss was good?
I can sort of go with that. I mean,
decisiveness is more important than correctness.
That's a very boss-like thing to say, Ben.
Well, speaking of benevolent bosses, I say we take a break and then we come back for the second half of our list.
I agree with that, and I think I'll give you a good annual review, Ben.
Yeah, no, also, I'm going to need to see you in my office later. We have to discuss your continued employment here.
Trigger run.
Work sucks.
All right, be right back.
And we're back. We're going to start out with Medalist because, well, the Olympics will be over by the time you listen to this, but they're wrapping up now. There was a very weird thing where the American hockey team beat the Canadian hockey team and our government was a bunch of disgusting scapegraces about it. But in terms of figure skating, Medalist was not only an enjoyable anime, but a great help in me understanding how short routines are scored. In figure skating, it literally I watched the episode where the old ice rink owner explained how like jumps are scored right before watching Ilya do his short form routine in the semifinals, and it was it's a good show. I think that the mark of a good sports anime is that it tricks you into thinking that you could be and perhaps always were a fan of this sport. That's definitely the case with figure skating, where I was watching, you know, Alyssa Liu and all these other Amber Glenn and being like, oh yeah. Oh, they went in the second half. They did a combo in the second half to get the 10% score bonus and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think about it all?
It's definitely being shown at the right time. Hopefully Disney sees Alyssa Liu winning gold and everyone going mad about her performance
with anime hair. She's got some hardcore anime hair too, also. So
and the tragedy, as you say, about Amber Glenn, like on the BBC, the coverage, they have like the running difficulty execution, and most times it will like tick up a couple of points. Amber Glenn sort of starts her program and she just does this triple, and it's just like the score just shoots up like 12 points, and the commentators are like, well, that's incredible.
When she missed that jump, she did a double instead of a triple and her score plummeted.
Yeah,
and like all grade of execution, got to explain that to my friends, seemed really cosmopolitan being able to explain ice skating to my friends thanks to my anime about a weird girl who digs up worms to go skating.
I feel like there's been less of a focus on Inori this season, and we're getting far more Tsukasa. They're getting far more of in the latest episode Jun commenting to him like, yeah, sure, you had a short window to display your talent, but you deciding that you couldn't make it is to him a failure on your part rather than necessarily mm-hmm. the narrative we've been sort of given. So from his side, yeah. where I started too late to ever really do the technical things the best people did. And so I had to choose expression as my way of excelling within the sport.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really appreciate this idea to have the generational genius, Jun, who like the big reveal in the latest episode is like he's kept improving. He retired, but he's better than ever. And yet he doesn't care about potential or inborn skill. Like you are what you've achieved. And if you've achieved nothing, you have no skill, is his argument. And his attempt to like lead our beloved nerdy Inori Stan coach off the path is just like, here's you doing a backflip. Like this will get you into any ice dancing routine company you want. You don't have to be a coach of some 11-year-old girl. You can make it yourself. And like watching him face that last temptation of Christ and be like, no, I'm here to support Inori's career. Like that's what I'm using my potential for. And I don't care that you think I haven't accomplished anything if I never like won a medal or participated in a specific event. Wonderful, because I've been thinking a lot about anime anti-hero antagonists / deuteragonists who are just like, Sasuke is the only word I can use for it, of just like, they're also the protagonist, but they're a dick about it, and that's and that's their character. And for Jun to be just to have kind of entered more fully, because he's been this really like austere, distant character, an unapproachable talent, someone who you will never equal, and him training Hikaru, who's also an unapproachable talent who you will never equal, and having him like get into it and be like, you have talent and you're wasted as a coach.
But to push back against his modesty, saying, well, all throughout the show, it's been said like, oh yeah, he can see a routine and he can understand it and he can help. He can immediately see what Inori's done wrong and help her improve it. And he can see how mm-hmm. other skaters are doing things and show Inori how to do it. And John sees him doing that and thinks, that's a really useful thing to have as a skater, and that's a talent. And immediately he does something which is incredibly technically difficult and goes, go on, you do it. And then he does it and he's like, you didn't seem surprised that you did that, did you? You weren't surprised. You knew that you were capable of doing this. And so stop being so modest about it.
It's a great moment. Yeah. And just having the older coach just like film him, and he's like, this is an insane thing to ask someone to do, like Cole, to do a skating backflip. It really is interesting how just like talent is not just a monolith. Talent is a series of discrete acts that you can advance or ignore. And I don't know, I enjoyed the novice tournament, and I like almost all of the new characters introduced except for the girl with the weird like blurry line eyes. I hate that design flourish. That's my melty fang. I hate the like three lines with like blurred shit over it, and she has no pupils.
It's a strange one,
but I'm happy. I'm the girl who is more like into like performing and like smiling and like controlling her auras, that's my new like secondary favorite character, because it is introducing more girls and more styles of doing things and kind of pursuing this multiplicity of talent. Akiuchi's like, it's like, oh, anything can happen on the ice, and Jun's like, no, only one thing happens on the ice and we know it ahead of time. And having that be kind of like the ideological divide, going out and skating is a dice roll versus going out and skating is a way of revealing who you truly are, and kind of having the underdog be like, anyone can win, and the anti-hero deuteragonist being like, no, the best person wins every time. One done a lot of times in anime, but in terms of ice skating, it feels especially chewy, especially toothsome.
I like that we got some little bits with Ryu, the young lad, qualifying from the regionals and being like, there was only two of us. There wasn't enough of us to actually have a competition, so we just qualified by default.
No, the cutaway to like just two guys on the podium in first and second, and that's all. It's just like, yeah, that's it.
And the latest episode where we get a glimpse at the fact that they're basically at the boundary between young adult and sort of actual competitors.
Mm-hmm.
Them seeing this 16-year-old skater doing all these impressive physical things and going, wow, look at a six-pack, literally. And then them thinking, wait a second, next year we go up to that bracket, shit.
Yeah, and I appreciate that especially because, like, maybe it's just my memory as an old pathetic man, but like from like 8 to 15 is the fastest you'll ever grow up, and it feels like forever. But also, like, yeah, every year you are objectively at a new development level, and having a woman who's older who's just like butchering them, and she's just like, I hate skating among these kids.
In fairness, I think she's more than, she's at the upper end of the bracket rather than the, and they're
sure,
at the lower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But nevertheless, like, I had my growth spurt fairly early, and so I was
a late bloomer, so I can't talk.
I played the typically British sport of cricket at sort of county level, and was good enough to be shifted up to play against people older than me, because I was physically, I was able to dominate people my own age because I was physically bigger and stronger than them. But the moment you put me up against people who have at the same level of development, it becomes a hell of a lot harder. It's interesting that we haven't really got anyone who's described as like a physical beast. Maybe Hikaru to an extent. Dense, like she's described.
Haru's got the classic genius bloodline shit, yeah, that I feel like I've seen forever in anime. No, we don't have anyone who's just like outside of the normal like bell curve of physical development, because I do think that is something open. I think we have you know, people who don't know why they want to skate. We have people who want to focus on the jumps. We have people who want to focus on the stylings. But yeah, we don't have anyone who is just like, I don't know, the Beast Raban,
yeah.
the EVA 02 Beast Mode. We don't have anyone who's just like brute forcing their way through skating. And maybe we won't. Maybe it's not that kind of show. There's a lot of potential.
Yeah.
Because just the structure of the sport means you can't have someone come in to a competition and just wreck everyone. And the brief moment where all the coaches are meeting and we're like, we are not a winning region, like, Tokyo bodies us every single time. So after we win this meet, all the coaches meet up to strategize about how one of us can get to the finals.
Yeah.
Was really neat. And actually the focus on coaches, I appreciate just as a way to bring more of the technical stuff forward, because it's not just like train your students to be great and they'll win. The brackets and the seeds and stuff. It's a game you have to plan before you even win.
It should be sort of like the busy work, the paperwork, and it should be incredibly boring, and yet they somehow manage to make all this stuff still have a dramatic tension to it. The mundane having a drama of all of its own is not always an easy thing to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the show which we should talk about next is a show which I think it's often remembered for its moments of high fantasy and sakuga, but actually I think Flourish is sometimes best in its sort of mundane moments between stops, which is Frere and Beyond Journey's End, season 2.
Mm-hmm.
This is always a difficult one to talk about because it's like, well, yes, it was good.
Oh, I can go into this. I can go full medievalist on this because... They have focused on the travel aspect and the difference between regions, and I appreciate how, like, the purse is the big question, at least in the recent episodes, that, like, you're moving forward. You haven't spent all your capital at once taking a ship to the northern port, so you have to work your way north. And it's funny because neo-medieval understandings of economy and transfer were reduced to the main quest and the side quest in RPGs that attempted to capture a medieval feel. And watching that kind of like be recreated from first principles, where, you know, they're traveling north and they got to take a job, and yeah, this weird dwarf seems like an asshole, but he's offering 20 gold crowns to dig up some old beer so we can stay for 3 weeks. I don't think I've ever really seen that in anime. Just the idea that you have to take odd jobs, and it's not like a quest that you're doing to help people and you get a little money on the side, but like, no, we need to do this for money. like we can forage and we can like live extremely poor and sleep on the side of the road. It reminds me a lot of that that medieval time traveler guide that was on YouTube a year or two back, which I adore and you should listen to, listeners, of like how you travel in the Middle Ages before highways, before rest stops, before towns that won't kill you for being a weirdo. Yeah, there's a sense of lived-in-ness with Frieren, and I think that's often a word overused because it implies normal people, but Frieren especially, just like, it's shitty inns and bad food and taking undignified jobs. Like, she's possibly the most powerful living mage, traveling with also possibly the most powerful living mage and a fighter trained by one of the most powerful living fighters. They're eating shit every single day, and I love it, and I wouldn't have it any other way, and I wish we had more episodes, but 10 is enough, especially with the chibi shorts, which I am a ceaseless advocate of. Bring back tachikomatic days for every single show, please. I'm not kidding. It's not a joke.
Yeah, I like the term lit RPG gets thrown around a lot.
We're going to talk about Dungeon Crawler Carl now.
Nope, absolutely not.
Thank you. I
like the fact that Frieren sort of takes the logic of like JRPG dungeon exploring, where it's like, oh, we found the stairs down, now we have to go look for all the treasure chests, and taking that very much to heart. And similarly, taking the idea that you go to a town and you do all the side quests, like you don't just like power through. The one time Frieren tried to avoid doing that, she was punished for it. It's never like the focus of the show. Like the emotional core is still the characters going on a journey. But I like all the dressing of the world sort of being not explicitly an RPG world, following that logic in a way that's more organic than somebody like, you know, pulling up a virtual item menu or like seeing like an overlay of like, oh, this guy has this skill and this power and things like that. Like it's never that contrived, but it still sort of clings to those things in a way that is amusing more so than it is like trying to like do anything overly cool with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Frieren's thesis that there is nothing particularly impressive about killing the demon lord, and it's just another quest, and it's just a very normal way of making your way through the world, is the charming part of it. Frieren is boring and embarrassing by turns. The gag where she's like, oh, you've never seen me throw a tantrum. And then there's like a 3-minute clip of her just trashing her room for like half a week about something. And it's just like, yeah, I mean, we edit things down to the bold and the impressive, but there's plenty of shitting your pants in between doing the brave thing. And I feel Frieren really understands that the charming thing about fantasies is they're ultimately fulfilled by people, very unremarkable people, even if they are unknowably old. And just before Stark and Fern's date, when Frieren's like, when a man and a woman go out with no particular goal, that's a date. And even Fern's like, no, I don't think that's true. And Frieren has her like saucy broad smile going on. The pleasant intrusion of mundanity into like profound fantasy matters is a great pleasure, and it's something Frieren never fails to fulfill. The most boring day of your life is also probably the most impressive day of your life at the end of time. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it captures.
And
it
I like
well.
How she was just present during, you know, what were formative mythological times for other people. Like, she knew the person who made the bad booze and who tried to warn everybody off by putting up a, like, you know, those like toxic waste warnings that are supposed to, like, you know, it's like, you know, this is not a
there is
yeah,
no
this
honor
is not
here.
A place of honor. There is nothing of value here, you know, and putting all of her terrible booze behind this, like, you know, unbreakable seal, and that becoming like the life goal of this dwarf guy. And the lesson being that, like, oh, the point of booze is to have fun drinking with your friends. And
yeah,
that's a great way to end that.
Only alcoholics care about good booze. Like, everyone else just drinks to have fun with their friends. It's lovely. It's extremely human, which is funny because it's a show a lot about how, like, there are very different modes of being quote unquote human with the demons and the elves and the dwarves and all that. But it is about how like how lovely and I keep saying mundane, how lovely and quotidian. I'm a thesaurus. These things are. Did anyone have a transition idea? None of these are my shows. Sentenced to be a hero? Are you sentenced to be a hero? Like yeah. Furin?
I mean, I think the opposite of Furin in many ways is sentenced to be a hero, which is all sizzle, no substance. What if convicted criminals were made immortal and sent to the front lines with a magical chain around their neck, which would blow up if they tried to run away? And they
that sounds awful.
And one of them, and guess what? Our main protagonist was innocent, Ben. You would never guess that the protagonist of the show is not, in fact, a worthless criminal. He's, in fact, a good man who was framed, and it was the corruption of the system which led him to there, and that his quirky band of misfits also are in many ways not who they seem to be, and it generally looks pretty good.
How boring for everyone to be innocent. How boring.
Yeah,
this goes back to Trigun. Everything's goes back to Trigun. Make your characters make bad decisions. Sorry.
Gunho Gun's just sitting around and being like, oh, I'm going to teach the kids music now.
It happens. Did you watch that episode? Oh my God. All the Gunho Guns died because they are specific challenges to Vash's worldview, and they need to die because he can't talk them around through his immortal, ceaseless prattling. They have to give him a, like, dagger in the heart of his actual opinions, and they need to die so he can't talk it out with them.
So, yeah, it is this typical rogues gallery of people, and they're all good at heart. It's like, oh, one of them's a multiple murderer. But you know what, Ben? Do you know who he kills, Ben? Only people who are committing horrible crimes worse than him.
Hot take.
Oh.
Hot take. Killing bad peoples is goated.
On top of that, so the whole thing is there's this these artificially created goddesses who are basically weapons of mass destruction. This one, Tarita, has the power to summon millions of swords and looks good, raining swords down on people. Pretty good. Impressive.
Anti-coded.
Yeah.
Like that?
It's like, oh, and you're being attacked by the Blight. Oh, this insidious thing which corrupts everything. And there's humans who are on the side of the corrupted one. They're hidden within society. And it's like, oh, these are all the tropes.
Oh, they watched Wheel of Time. That's exciting. They read Wheel of Time, probably. Yeah. Or maybe they watched it. Who knows? The show was good.
The one thing I did like about it is this one of the goons. They've all got sort of like faux medieval names, like the hero's called Xylo Forbarts, and there's a daughter Luzulas, and a Jance Patrice, and...
Xylo?
Yeah. But there's one guy called Tatsuya, and he's a guy who got isekai'd there years ago and has been fighting as part of the unit for so long he's lost all his memories and he's just like this ravening idiot now. So, and I did enjoy like the isekai protagonist is basically a guy in the background who's just killed so many things and blown up so many things. He's just an axe wielding maniac now.
Yeah, isekai is random secondary character is extremely funny, and I'm surprised I haven't seen it more. We're just like, oh yeah, I came from another reality. I have no soul anymore.
Living in the second half of the 2020s means that if an action show has got the budget, it will look pretty good a lot of the time, but that doesn't necessarily mean it is good. And that is what I would encourage people to remember about the show. Just because it occasionally looks good and feeds you some visual candy, do not be fooled. But there's better visual candy out there. Go watch some Fate Strange Fake. It's far better. Even if you are feeling a bit edgy, you can go and watch JJK. Or maybe I'll allow some people to watch Hell's Paradise, which does have a season 2. I think, like, God, how many years apart is this? Like 4 years? No, 3 years apart since season 1 of Hell's Paradise. And it's more goons on an island fighting weird plant monster humans and having special ninja or samurai powers. and it's okay. It is aggressively okay. It's got past the point where there was enough mystery about the island for it to be interesting, and now it's done. No, this is just the explicit ways that we've now got our earth, water, and iron, and air Pokemon ninjas, and you've got to find the weak points. They've got to find the correct matchups, because if Gabby Mew uses fire, that's super ineffective, and so we've got to use the water Pokemon ninja instead. And it's all just become finding your best matchup. Therefore, it has been ditched. What hasn't been ditched is the continually excellent Oshinoko. The problem I have of talking about the continually excellent Oshinoko is it's the third series of the continually excellent Oshinoko. And if people haven't watched the previous two seasons of consistently excellent Oshinoko, they will not know how consistently excellent it has been. And I can try and describe it, but there's two seasons of context, and trying to make any sort of description of what makes this season better or worse than the previous ones without that thing is basically impossible.
Welcome to my world.
The only thing I can say I have been a little frustrated about is that end of last season we basically got a reveal where there was a false reveal of, oh, maybe we've solved this mystery, and then a proper reveal of, oh, actually this is the true mastermind all along. And so I was hoping, okay, we're going to move towards a conclusion now. Instead, nah, we're going to sort of like draw back from that, and that's not going to come back into the cast awareness for at least a couple of episodes. Instead, we're going to see them variously pushing their careers forwards and having success, and then in different ways crashing and burning. I mean, Oshinoko started with, like, the plot point which instigates the whole show is an idol getting murdered by an obsessive fan. So for this season's main focus to be fame isn't actually good all the time doesn't feel like a huge development. It feels like it's gone back to what it was dealing with in the first season, whereas the second season was much more about, this is what it means to be a professional in acting and in theatre, and about what it takes, the work you had to put in. And it was interesting to see characters grow, and to, in the same way that Medalist shows us like the inside track on skating, it was showing us the way that theatre deals with things in interesting ways. And that's all gone on the back burner. It's all back to celebrity gossip. It's all back on actresses setting others up to have their photo took by paparazzi, people getting drunk and tattletaling, and social media storms, which has been a bit disappointing. It's still well executed. It just feels like it's already told me this, and I was hoping that we were advancing things, and it's sadly not. And so I hope it'll find its way again as this season goes on, but it wasn't terrible. It's just not up to the heights of season two. That's all I have to say on Oshinoko. I can't think of a good transition to one show people do have good things to say about.
Well, speaking of the second season being good and the third season being not as good, let's talk about Polar Opposites.
A show in its first season.
Because they're opposite. The seasons are opposite. I'm trying, man. I don't know. I love this. This is probably my favorite romantic comedy since Kare Kano. Although I have favorable mentions for like Ore Monogatari, and I like fast moving romances where the ripples into the social circle are the main thing that have to deal with, because a lot of romance anime just narrow the scope down to the two characters, and it's all about them, one person affecting the other person. And in this case, almost every episode, there's some sort of mismatch of opinion, and they go and talk to their friends, and they come with a synthesis. And especially in the latest episode, they realize that they've been worrying about a fake fight that neither of them wants to have. They just misinterpreted each other's instances. And Suzuki is just all in on Yamada's new romance, and Tani was thinking it was about him. It's good. Because at least in my experience, these junior high and high school romances happen in matrices of social analysis. And the idea that even a successful couple can stabilize relationships around them that cause other successful couples to form is, I think, a profound truth that anime rarely interacts with. And if it does interact with it, it's at a long-term sort of thing, like in Kimi ni Todokai, where Sadako, being normal with a man inspires all of her friends to be normal with men. But in Polar Opposites, it's much subtler. It is much more focused on everybody, how everybody's affected by two of their friends starting to date in a very sincere and grounded way. And even black-pilled Tyra, who I feel eternally called out by. Oh my God. Do not enjoy that mirror being held up to me. And even he, we can see he's being slowly drawn towards another woman in the group, the other burnout, who believes that I can only date assholes. And so dating is a lie. It's great. It's good. I don't know. Having the dumb jockish blonde guy and the shy stuttering girl just to have a romance for the past three episodes is great. It's how people interact. When I look for romance, I'm not looking for gratification of my own romantic status. I'm not looking for a power fantasy of just two people impossibly falling in love. I'm looking for one of the most intense emotional moments that you can experience as a 16 or 17 year old be played out. And the way that these characters surprise each other, especially, is what I love.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the latest episode, which I don't know if you've watched, Jeff or Duncan, where Tani gets freaked out that Suzuki is jealous of Nishi's relationship with him. And no, she just clocked that Yamada likes her and she's trying to figure out how she can help out. And Tani has to be like, oh my God, I talked to black-pilled Tyra. And he's like, yeah, she's jealous. And then I actually go and talk to my girlfriend. And she's like, no, just wanted my friend to find love. And that is the most 17-year-old thing I've experienced in a while. I'm just spent a whole day oh my God, my relationship's burning down because I talked too much to another woman. Nope. Nope. She gets you.
I think it was the episode before when Tani and Tyra are at the Konbini and he sees two girls talking. They're like, they're talking shit about me. We gotta get out of here. And then it just flips back to them and it's does not care at all.
Yeah. I literally had that experience last night where I saw two of my coworkers talking and I'm like, I had to be to myself they're probably not talking about you. They're probably not talking about you, Ben. You should just ignore that you saw this. Yeah. It's.
I was going to say, how do you feel about the contrivance of every pairing being polar opposites?
Eh.
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 Yeah.
I didn't like that Yamada said we're polar opposites, literally, while talking with Nishi. That's beneath you, anime writers.
I think maybe this is actually bait dangled for me, because speaking of someone who's favorite rom-com of the past couple of years is Makine, Losing Heroines. For me to see a dating situation and go, nah, man, too contrived for me. I think that there's a pretty high bar which has somehow been still knocked over. And Yamada and Nishi's, he loves girls who are quiet because he likes the moment when they show emotion. It's fucking hell, that's contrived.
Have you watched the latest episode where he admits, he's like, actually, you laugh a lot, Nishi. I didn't realize this, but you laugh all the time. It's about what we see in other people as much as who they are, which I think is one of the things that Polar Opposites does well, is especially when you're in these intensive social circles, you build stereotypes of the people around you. And oftentimes the moment of romantic adhesion is realizing that your stereotype is keeping you seeing from what's actually charming about the person. And I do think Yamada being like, I like girls who are hard. Well, he's not. The show literally tells us.
Yeah, the show gives us a 5-minute presentation on his fetishes.
I won't say it's not belabored, but I do think that him only liking girls who are hard to make laugh, and him having the realization in the latest episode, Nishi's actually an easy laugh. She's a super easy laugh. It's really not hard to upset her expectations and make her giggle at you. it captures very well what it feels like to suddenly fall in love in your teens, is to realize that you have this preset notion of who someone is and realize it's wrong, and they're actually, they can charm and surprise you. And I'm not going to say that it's not like very confidently on rails. We have all the couples, like they show us all of them in the OP. And I'm very excited for Tyra and side part blonde girl to hook up, because that's my, that's going to be my goat. I'm sure once they, we only have 12 episodes. Are we going to make it? I'm worried. It's also the problem.
You not but, get too coarse of this as a standard.
I do like that, that the show very frequently tells you who these characters think they are and who they think their friends are. And then they show that these are inadequate assessments, and that actually love is realizing that you don't understand another person. It reminds me a little bit of Ikokuniki, of just like, love is the gap. Love is the gap between what you assume and who they are. And you can never approach who they are, so that gap is infinite. That's what love is just like, you think it's just this little bit, but it's, it goes on forever, and you just more and more and more, and you're just drawn into this person. And both of those shows, Ikokuniki in the drama side and Polar Opposites largely in the comedy side, really, really capture that for me, of just like, joy in life is being interested in other people. And both of these shows show that, like, you can't just understand a person, dust your hands off, you're done. There's an infinite lesson being taught there. And I get if you don't get it. And I do think that, like, it's very convenient that we have all of these polar opposites who are all part of the same friend group. But I'm fine with it. I need love right now a lot. I'm living in a dying country, and I need these fucking Japanese kids to all just complete each other, because I am not complete. So I don't know.
Now, see, I want more broken adults trying to find love, and like people who are missing a
fundamental... Maybe you should watch Karikano. These people are broken, and finding their other half will not fix them in Karikano. And it's kind of nice to have polar opposites where, like, oh, finding your other half does fix you is my place.
Yeah. The romance I've most enjoyed this season was an episode of Journal of a Witch, but I also have watched a few episodes of a show which we had a write-in about, which Andy's forwarded on to us.
Our beloved correspondent.
Ben Kay has written in saying, really enjoyed your 2025 retrospective, as always. At the end, you begin to talk about the winter 2026 season, and you lord, you and I are polar opposites, as we have done again. Ben, I do apologize.
I won't
in
stop.
That show, the main couple immediately started dating, and he wanted to let us know that the Invisible Man and his soon-to-be wife also has a couple that starts dating early in the season, and wondered what we thought of the comparison of those two shows. Now, I have watched a couple of episodes of this show, and I think that the thing for me is its setup is Invisible Man dating blind woman. So his obvious disability, as it were, of not being seen is counteracted by her forming her impressions of him in different ways, which is a romance staple. Like, the idea that someone doesn't judge you on your appearance is pretty much a staple of any any romance. And so this has it baked in at the fundamental level. And as other Ben mentions, it's I'm just trying to think. He's a latter Ben rather, and you're an early Ben.
No, he's written in. He wanted me to watch more Rent a Girlfriend. So I think he's a saboteur, honestly. But we love you, Ben K.
Yeah. So the has that stuff baked in, and because it has some of the tropes of romance already sort of there as a sort of fundamental characteristic of the two characters, it is able to sort of move to them going on dates and starting to be a couple quicker. All that said, I found it incredibly... I think that's wrong. No, I found it quite saccharine at times. Like, it is, they are very nice to each other. They are incredibly considerate. There has not yet been any conflict between them, either of them. And one thing I did enjoy in the recent run of Polar Opposites is, as you have pointed out, Ben, that there are moments where that they have anxiety about how each other thinks about each other, how mm-hmm. Tani meets Suzuki's first boyfriend and then immediately is jealous about it. And that I'm broken in a different way from you, Ben. It's like I don't even glory in the car crashes of Karakano or enjoy the sweet first love of you and I are polar opposites. I just want the cynical pessimism of losing heroines.
You want Scum's Wish. You want Scum's Wish.
Scum's Wish and losing heroine, where yeah. It's just the like, it's everything's going to fail and that's just the way it is. I'm just going to sit here and be cynical about it.
I can't. I'm single right now. I need to believe in love. I can have like awful doomed romances once I'm in a relationship.
So. Oh dear. I haven't got far enough into this yet, but there is a supporting cast where I suspect it's going to do that thing where at some point the supporting cast can start to hook up. There's a slightly grumpy member of the Invisible Man's detective agency who I think is going to hook up with the strong wolf girl, which is a show which is frankly just that I'd probably watch that show more than this one, although that saying, I am a coward who didn't watch With You I'll Make It Through last season, which means I'm clearly not strong enough to knock back full furry, and I just take it with a dash of cola and to make it go down. Although next season we are about 2 weeks away from the finale of Beastars finally getting aired on Netflix, which I'm looking forward to finding out how that's going to get its anime original ending. That has been another prime example of a complete rolling road of crashing relationships where there's clear attraction between people early on, and yet there's finding ways their relationship would be a disaster constantly throughout in many different ways. And I don't feel like anyone's going to get the happy ending in Beastars, so maybe it's good that things like Polar Opposites and the Invisible Man and his soon-to-be wife exist, where the good ending's baked in rather than it all heading towards the inevitable tragedy of a breakup. I don't know, romance. I feel like it's just like I've got fed up of romances where there's no tension in the romance, where it's going to be, of course they're going to get together, and the only thing which we're debating is, oh, how quickly are they going to get together? Are we going to get frustrated because they're taking too long to get together? Are they going to get together quick, and we get to see the relationship developing with them in a relationship, but them still doing the same things which people do in it before they're dating? I don't know. It feels like so few of us ever end up with our first love. There is, yeah. Makine still remains one of the few shows who's to properly acknowledge the damage and problems everyone gets themselves into. And like, I like that there's been some of that in Polar Opposites. I just don't think, I think the fact that we so often have shows which are set with teenagers means that we very rarely actually get to see people dealing with the relationships as I've been living with them for the past majority of my life.
I mean, yes. Would I love a working professionals, especially, look, I've already called into being like nomad court political drama. We're getting stuff with the Mongol court. We're getting all sorts of things. I'm going to call it into being mid-30s academics trying to date is what I want, because like that is also a very weird corner of human existence where, yeah, you've all experienced failure. I mean, all romance is failure until you find the right one, and then even not forever, maybe. So I agree with that like there is something lessening about the focus on adolescent first love. But at the same time, if it's all we're going to get, I want it to be good.
I guess. You can have a Rui on the rocks about her post-grad breakup.
God. What's her name? Naki, as like, she's 36. She's had a four-year marriage that just, they were in the same department and they were married for 4 years. And now Rui joins the department as a young girl and, I'm just asking for portraits of a life is what I'm at the end of the day. It's not an interesting question. I liked the idea of what Invisible Man was offering. The show didn't seem to really be there, but I will always ask for more mature romances. It's just there's no anime audience for romance over the age of 30 at the end of the day. And there may never be.
It has to get smuggled in.
I mean, maybe as the audience ages, as we all age, as we all fall victim to the winds of time, perhaps I will someday I will someday get something that speaks to my specific experience. But as it stands, anime will have to be a eternal childhood, where I can relitigate being a bad boyfriend at 16.
Well, I did enjoy Asa just being in the latest episode of Don't Know With Witch, being just completely
resentful. She's so mean.
Yeah, she's so resentful. It's
like... She's so mean. Oh my God. Like, someone on Blue Sky was just like, Asa continues to keep the ability to just have the most cutting, painful insults to the adults in her life for falling short of her. And I agree. This girl's a nightmare. I'm glad Makio has to deal with her and not me, because the way she's just like, oh, like the way that you retreated into your books instead of dealing with real human emotion, and Makio's like, yeah, I guess. Just like,
shut up.
What do you know, kid? You are almost two decades younger than me. You have no idea what kind of shit you're in for. It would be hard not to. But she deals with it with such grace. She's just like, no, this is just my opinion as an adult who's seen some things, but not everything.
And if you're wanting romance between adults, the Monkey's Paw of anime has already curled for you. And we're getting a series of Smoking Behind the Supermarket with You. So look forward to that.
I'm trying not to be excited about that. I'm focusing all my energy on nomadic court dramas.
Yeah. Oh, and we got another one of those announced last week. We got Red River, which is historical isekai.
Persian, right?
Yeah.
In the Persian court. Yeah. That's going to be good. I mean, no, it's not. But I hope.
That'd be good.
All right. Let's call it there. For our next episode, you're all going to get a treat. We are going to go ahead and do the first half of the 50-episode Turn A Gundam from 1999, the last cell-painted Gundam made by Sunrise, and my favorite anime for the next season, at least.
I think we obviously had our anniversary show, and I thought it would be nice for us all to just basically revisit our faves this year, like to revisit the things which we really love about the best of this, and to just indulge in the good and to share that with people, because some of these shows are now actually in the deep past to people, and so it's no harm in bringing it back.
And also no forthcoming adaptations or easy releases.
Oh yeah, certainly that motherfucking region
Sony
one.
Aniplex doesn't care about you didn't hear it from me, but they're on YouTube and in almost Blu-ray quality. And so it's your time to watch a Gundam.
Yeah, and that's the other reason to like, do it, just before like someone takes notice and takes it all down. That's why we're mainlining this.
This is what we're left to. Gundam, the big property, like the biggest anime property after Dragon Ball, it feels like. And yet. All right. Well, rate, review, and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook, search for Keyframes Pod. Find us on Blue Sky, Keyframes Pod as well. And most of all, tell a friend.
But not just any friend. Your polar opposite.
Yeah. Tell the friend who after you give them the opportunity to advocate for the most wonderful thing in the medium, would make you watch Bocchi the Rock again.
My coworkers found out that I do a podcast, and one of them literally said, "What, like Dragon Ball?" Which is the most I've ever been destroyed in my life.
We've never, in 10 years, it's 10 years, and we've never once, I don't think, talked about Dragon Ball.
You and John have talked about it, I think.
I mean, John's talked about Dragon Ball. He's just not here right now.
Okay. Well, the three of us have never talked about Dragon Ball. Yes.
Because no, I haven't seen any. I haven't seen any Dragon Ball. I'm just not interested.
No Dragon Ball, no Naruto, no Bleach.
Okay, you're reaching out with Naruto and maybe like the first season of Bleach. When she's living in his like cupboard and they're fighting demons at night, the first season of Bleach is excellent. Just turn it off after that.
Yep.
They say they're going to Soul Society. Turn it off. Turn it off. Imagine what it's going to be. Say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.